This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
I was given a newspaper clipping this past week by somebody in our church about an exercise program. I'm not sure why they gave it to me. I'm sure they meant well. So I thought I'd give it to you. It was pretty amazing, actually. That was good advice. Here it is. Begin by standing on a comfortable surface where you have plenty of room at each side. With a 5-pound potato bag in each hand, extend your arms straight out from your sides and hold them there as long as you can. Try to reach a full minute, then relax for a few minutes and repeat the process 3 more times each day. After 2 weeks, move up to a 10-pound potato bag in each hand. Repeat the exercise. After you feel confident, several weeks later, move up to a 25-pound potato bag. Repeat the process. And when you feel confident at this level, begin putting a potato in each bag. I can do that. How about you? Huh? Let's do that. I couldn't help but think about the fact that we're surrounded by people with advice, aren't we, about everything. Sometimes they're laughing and sometimes they're very serious. We're in a world of consulting, much of it good. Primarily, much of it is, you know, how to get ahead in life, and while you're at it, how to get the most out of life. And there's an awful lot of advice about that. The more successful a person appears to be, the more infallible their advice seems to be. So whether they're a successful athlete or entrepreneur or whatever it might be, well, surely they must be right. One article caught my eye recently, and I put it in my file, pulled it out this week, a network channel put together from this one individual whose name will remain nameless. An older man is very wealthy. They culled together pieces of wisdom, they called it, from his writings, from his interviews. His best pieces of advice, they claimed, and I could just see people gobbling it up and writing it down. Among those best pieces of advice were these. Associate, he said, with high-grade people. I'm not sure if we qualify, but make sure you're around high-grade people. I mean, you got to dump a few friends along the way. They're not making the income you want to make. He would say, be around people who have what you want. Associate with high-grade people. Another piece of advice was rather well-worn. Invest in yourself. That just simply means make sure you're at the center of your world and you're more important than anything else. He gave advice on marriage, and frankly, people should have started laughing or looking elsewhere. He said this, marry the right person. It's hard to interpret what he meant by that until you look at his life, where he evidently didn't marry the right person, because after a couple of decades, he left her, moved in with his girlfriend, and for the next 28 years lived with her, and then finally decided she was the right one and married her. Frankly, for people like him, and our world is filled with them, to give advice on marriage or friendship or the meaning of life is like following the advice of someone who is telling you how to get stronger by holding empty potato bags. One of the most critical things in life is to follow the right advice. To listen to the right voice. And for today, I'm not talking about mine. I'm talking about God's. His word. His truth. In fact, one of the richest men to ever live on the planet is reaching the end of his life, recognizes he spent decades following the wrong voice and living the wrong life, and he attempts to settle the score and set things right in many ways by writing a personal journal. He wants his son Rehoboam to read it, and we've been studying it ever since. Turn back there with me, would you? It's called the Book of Ecclesiastes if you're new to our study. And we arrive at a place in this journal where Old Testament scholars consider it the middle part of his journal. Chapters 4 through the end of chapter 10 are considered the middle section in this book. And you're going to notice as we study it together, it sounds a lot like the book of Proverbs. It has short paragraphs, seemingly disconnected thoughts. It's nearly impossible to outline, if at all. He covers a tremendous amount of territory in a very brief period of time. It's kind of like a survival guide. It's, in a manner of speaking, it's a manual to avoiding the pitfalls and the dead ends, how to navigate rough water in life. And if the first part of his journal could be referring to finding meaning under the sun, this middle part of his journal, I think, could be entitled Surviving Evil Under the Sun. And what he does at the very outset is he begins to describe very graphically and very realistically the world around him. And you discover fairly quickly that the world over the last 3,000 years hasn't changed an ounce. We're in chapter 4. He pulls back the curtain on four different scenes and describes them for us. Now, if we had a program guide that I'll sort of create as a way to outline it, the first scene could be entitled Heartless Oppression, and you could subtitle it in your playbill something like Being on the Wrong Side of Earthly Power. The curtain opens. Verse 1 reads, notice there, of chapter 4, again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. The scene is a very emotional entry in Solomon's journal. Twice he says there's no one to comfort them. In other words, there's no escape, no vindication, no improvement, no rescue in sight. He is essentially saying there is no earthly resource down here under the sun to give them comfort. We'll come back to that in a little bit. This is an intensely emotional entry. It isn't really meant for speed reading, although we're going to have to move through it fairly quickly. But he's looking around. He's spent a long time. He's an older man. And he categorically describes the world as full of oppression. He'll use this Hebrew root word for oppression three times, by the way, in that one verse we've just read. Notice, look back there, he uses it first to describe the actions around him. I saw all the oppressions. Those are the deeds. Then he uses it to describe the victims. And behold, look, the tears of the oppressed. They have no recourse other than tears of despair. Then the third time Solomon uses it to describe the culprits. Notice, on the side of their oppressors, there was power. So you have oppressions, you have the oppressed, and you have the oppressors. And as I dug into my Hebrew help in my study, this root word refers to those in power who abuse. Burden literally could be rendered to trample or to crush those who are weaker or smaller or indefensible or poorer or lower down there on the food chain. Poor them. Now, Solomon, you'll notice, doesn't specify exactly individuals he's thinking of, and I think that's good because, frankly, you can stuff everything in there. He's simply referring to, in this particular scene, those with more power than others, and they misuse it to crush other people, to hurt others. The oppressor might be an abusive husband or parent. It can include everybody from a bully at school to a dictator in some country, a sex slaver, an abortionist, a gang leader, a pimp, an employer in a suit, a child abuser in secret. The word for oppression can refer to depriving someone that has no legal recourse of land or personal rights or even food. It includes those who suffer under tyrannical rule for their faith, as millions are suffering today around our world for their testimony of following Christ. You don't have to live for very long before you can add to that list that I created in my study in about 3 minutes of what it means to oppress others. And you don't have to live very long in the world before you'll see your own illustrations with your own eyes of oppression acting out on the stage of human history. You go all the way back to the beginning. You go back to Adam and Eve. And it all began with their sin. They're expelled from the garden in chapter 3, and 8 verses later, you have a record of the first murder. Longer time involved, but it just took 8 verses in the record of human history before you get to the first event where an older brother, stronger, more powerful, rises up in a rage of envy and kills his younger brother for doing the right thing. Oppression. The corruption of the human heart seems to defy description. Like the teenage boy a few days ago I read about in our country who got into his pickup truck and he was driving. He passed an elderly man walking down the street with his cane, minding his own business. This young man did a U-turn, sped up, and literally ran over that man, crushing him to death. And when he was caught and later interviewed just a couple of days ago, he said, just as cavalier as you can imagine, that he just wanted to know what it would feel like to kill somebody. You follow the news, our world is filled with oppression. And with this kind of heavy, weighty, discouraging scene, you would think that following that description, Solomon would repeat what he said over in chapter 3, where he would remind everybody that God is sovereign, and one day all of human history will culminate in holy justice. God will make everything right. He doesn't. He's focusing on down here, you notice, under the sun. And he comes up with this particular conclusion. Look at verse 2. So I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been born, that is, and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. You come to the conclusion. This is the perspective of somebody stuck down here under the sun without any comfort and belonging to the God of all comfort. Even though there aren't answers, there is the answer. It is him. But here under the sun, you get stuck down here. And like Solomon, you come to the observation, it's better to be dead than alive. Tragically, 130 people in our country today, on average, are going to come to that same conclusion and end their lives. And one of the tragedies of our civilized world, our Western world, is this increasing rate of suicide. Solomon isn't recommending suicide. He's actually saying it would be better to have never been born at all than have to suffer through this kind of world, which is heartless and destructive and corrupting and dangerous and selfish and painful. It'd be better to have never been born. Twice he writes there without comfort. He uses, by the way, the same Hebrew word as Dad used over in Psalm 23, which hints at where we find our only real and true and lasting comfort, where David writes in Psalm 23 of the good shepherd, his rod and staff, they what? comfort me. The ultimate source of comfort isn't down here under the sun, but from the Creator of the sun, like the believer I read about recently, a young lady living in a Muslim-majority world where she's now been disowned by her family. Her life is at risk. She's been disowned. She's put out. And she writes, "My life is in constant danger, but instead of despairing, I am finding comfort in God's word and God's presence." David, the psalmist, writes what Solomon no doubt sang growing up. He prays in poetry, such as in Psalm 119. "They draw near," he's praying to God, "they draw near who persecute me with evil purpose, but you are near, O Lord, all my ways are before you." In other words, you're seeing this. You know this. "I rise before dawn and cry for help. My hope is in your word." The opening scene is heavy. Describes a world of heartless oppression where people are on the wrong side of earthly power. Now, the second scene Solomon describes as equally widespread. In fact, it might be a little closer to home. We'll call it envious rivalry, and you could subtitle it keeping up with the Joneses. Notice verse 4, "Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work," you could translate that, "all success in work, all achievement in work comes from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and chasing after wind." Now, Solomon is speaking in general terms, and yet at the same time, he's saying things we might not, you know, really care to hear about, but he's essentially saying that one of the driving motivations out there in the rat race of this world is nothing less than competition. It's the fuel. It is the competing to succeed. Oh, and by the way, how do you determine success? It's determined by owning more than the other guy. It's by selling more, having more, possessing more, accomplishing more than your competitors, which is why you call them, we call them our competitors. Our world is often simply divided into two classes. They're either your clients or they're your competitors. A professor at the Harvard Business School, I tucked this away in my file some time ago, he writes about this disturbing trend he calls, quote, "comparison obsession." He writes, "A former student of mine who graduated 10 years ago and had a terrific job at a Fortune 500 company now suffers with comparison obsession. At least it seemed like a terrific job until she received her alumni newsletter and read that a fellow alumnus who was in the MBA program with her has just been named vice president at their company. And from that moment on, she can barely hold a conversation without bemoaning her lack of promotion." The professor goes on to write, "Business executives, I'm finding Wall Street analysts, lawyers, doctors, every profession out there seems to be equally obsessed with comparing their own achievements against those of others in their same profession." He concludes, "People are increasingly trapped by their comparison obsession." Solomon calls it something a lot less sophisticated. He calls it sin. Envy. Rivalry. Covetousness, the envying of success rather than the enjoyment of our own, that sinful desire that means we don't just want to get ahead, we want to get ahead of the other guy. It isn't enough to have enough, it's only enough if I have more than the other guy. We live in a world filled, one author wrote, with Joneses who are trying to keep up with other Joneses. My apologies if your last name is Jones, okay? This is not about you entirely. Any last name works. Even mine. How about yours? You say, well, Stephen, you're in the ministry. Well, I'm infected too with a fallen nature. Those in church leadership, I got to, you know, when I travel, no matter where it's going to be, I'm going to get asked the question, hey, I've heard about Colonial. How many people are attending? And now why is it that when I get asked that, I've got that momentary second where I'm tempted to give them the attendance from Easter Sunday? You know, just kind of inflate that baby. Or Christmas Sunday, when they all come back. Pastors are infected too. I enjoy reading one pastor's commentary. He was sitting in his living room, he writes in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, on one Sunday afternoon with his little six-year-old boy, just kind of relaxing. And his son, just out of the blue, asked, Daddy, when you sit up there on the platform, just before you get up to preach, you just sit there and for a minute, you bow your head. What are you doing? His father answered, I'm asking the Lord to give me a good sermon. His son replied, well, then why doesn't he? Go to your room, son. Even in church, man, even in the assembly, it's easy to forget, as A.W. Tozer put it so well, that we as Christians are not competitors, we are co-workers. Solomon paints a picture of someone trying to pass everybody else in the rat race. It's convicting. I drive that way. I don't know why, but I just got to pass somebody. I hate double yellow lines. Now with that, Solomon just suddenly reverses the scene. And he starts talking about what we'll call arrogant laziness. It's the opposite. We could subtitle it resigning from the rat race. Look at verse 5. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. I know that sounds gross, but what he means is he is self-destructing. He's cannibalizing himself. He's the victim of his own arrogance. So where did he get arrogance from? Well, keep in mind that a fool in the Bible has nothing to do with SAT scores. A fool in the Bible is someone wrapped up in themselves, absorbed with themselves. So here is somebody, here's what's happening. Here's somebody who thinks they're better than all those people out there in that rat race. Yeah, look at them all scramble. Look at them all fight. Not me. I'm going to resign from that, and I'm going to fold my hands, and I'm going to do as little as I possibly can do. You know what I'm talking about? You might work with a few of them. Doesn't mean they're unemployed. They're going to clock in, and they're going to clock out, and in between clocking in and clocking out, they're going to work really hard at avoiding what? Oh, you do work around a few of those, don't you? You're going to avoid work. They're lethargic. Nothing about their work inspires them or fires up their imagination. They're killing time. Solomon says, no, they're actually wasting their life. That isn't the solution either. If they're a believer, doubly worse. They're hurting their testimony and their reputation. They're expecting others to pull their weight and do the chores and sign up for the tough assignments. And they essentially expect to be served. We're just going to fold our hands. You serve me. I'm not going to serve you. They're not going to overcompete. So they end up underperforming. Neither one is a biblical work ethic to pursue. So Solomon is describing a scene of oppression and what it means to be the victim of earthly temporary power, and how the comfort must come from God, who is sovereign, who has placed us where he has placed us for his purposes, and those answers might come later. He describes a scene of rivalry and how we can get caught up in the rat race, and before you know it, we're really just trying to pass somebody else, and we're not sure why. He describes arrogant laziness, where we're just going to sort of resign and let those crazy people race and run and work, and we're just going to be served. Before I get to Solomon's response, let me take you to one more scene. Skip down to verse 7. He says this, "Again, I saw vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil." He's describing someone with blind ambition. He's describing a man who doesn't have an heir, doesn't have a family, doesn't have an extended family, by the way. And the implication here is that he doesn't want one. They're going to get in the way of his materialism and his money. Notice further, his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks. He never does come around asking the obvious question. For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. What he's describing here is a miser. That's why it came to my mind that, you know, the subtitle of the scene would be Imitating Ebenezer Scrooge. His nose is in the ledger. His only friends are money and work. He doesn't need anybody. He doesn't want anybody. And frankly, everybody's leaving him alone anyway. And Solomon informs us that this person never does look up, as it were, open his eyes, get past his bank account or his possessions or his toys or his trophies or whatever it might be, and say, "Why am I doing this? Why am I only working and living for myself? Why am I not helping anybody else? Why does everything belong to me? And why is it that there is no satisfaction in my riches? Why is it that today I'm just like I was last year and the year before? I still want more. I want more." He's pegged us, hasn't he? We find ourselves somewhere in these four scenes, perhaps one more than another. They describe the possibilities and the temptations of listening to the wrong voice, following the wrong advice. People with power say, "Hey, up here, this is the best. VIP. You got the club card. This is where it is." And if that's what they're living for, they are there as miserable as when they began climbing the hill. Others work hard, but the hidden motive is this drive to be better, to be applauded, to be more successful, to get an edge past somebody else. Others decide to get by. I'm gonna fold my hands. I'm living for the weekend. Don't expect much of a contribution. On Monday through Friday and on Sunday too. Others never take a breath. They never stop churning. They never stop counting their coins or their toys. And they don't seem to look up and notice that everybody has just sort of slipped away and left them alone in their little self-absorbed lives. Now, tucked in the middle of these scenes is this proverb. Notice it. Go to verse 6. "Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind." Solomon is describing someone, and if you want to write one word in your notes or maybe in the margin of your Bible right here at this text, it's the word balance. Wise balance. His hands, he describes, aren't folded and idle. He isn't trying to stuff more into two hands that are already stuffed full. But he hadn't given up on work either. He's got one working hand. But it's the picture of balance. And that hand is filled with what? Not things, not successes, not achievements, not possessions. It's quietness. That's a word in the Hebrew language that is synonymous with Contentment. Contentment. That's what it means. Solomon is describing balanced, wise contentment that says, I have one hand, and I have one handful. God has given me what I have. I'm using it. I'm working for it. I'm diligent. I'm improving it. I'm doing my due diligence with it. But I understand it's from God, and it is ultimately for God. And one hand is enough. It's enough. See, grasping and greed and envy and rivalry and competition, all described here in this text, and it struck me. And this is somewhat of an artificial outline, but it struck me that they have this in common. None of these scenes have anybody in them where they're able to say, I have enough. I have enough power. I have enough success. I have enough leisure. No. They will always count up not what they have, but what they want, and yet do not have. And Solomon, right here, did you notice how the proverb begins with the word better? Here's something better. Here's something, circle that word. This is superior. This is worth pursuing. This is a voice to listen to. This is inspired advice to follow. And by the way, if you listen to this voice, which is the advice of God's Spirit, it will invite you to trust what God has put in your hand. Just enough. Now use it, work at it, enjoy it. Ultimately, give Him glory for it. I can't think of a more powerful testimony, frankly, of contentment in recent generations than about 100 years ago from an 8-year-old girl who had every reason to spend her life complaining for what had been taken away from her. When she was 6 weeks old, she caught a cold. Family physician was away. There was a country doctor somebody told them about in town and was recommended to see her in passing. Turns out he wasn't a doctor. He was pretending. He prescribed some hot poultices to be applied to her eyelids, which had become swollen with a rash. The infection cleared up eventually, but the treatment scarred her eyes, and it wasn't long before her parents realized that she had lost her sight. The country doctor had long since disappeared. It was never seen again. When she was 5 years old, friends and neighbors collected enough money to send her to a specialist to see if anything could be done. Even though she was 5 years old at the time, she would later write, she never forgot hearing that doctor eventually say to her, "You poor child. You will probably never see again." That wasn't her attitude. She would give her life to the Lord when she was old enough to understand the gospel and committed her life to Christ. And she turned to poetry to express her confidence and contentment. And it wasn't long before Fanny Crosby wrote her first poem. It came back to my mind. It's convicting. It's confrontive for those of us in a world engulfed with status and power and prestige and rivalry and competition and arrogance. She seemed to understand this proverb of wise balance, even at a very young age, that God had put something in her hand and she would use it. She would work at it. She would glorify Him with it. And so her first poem, written when she was only 8 years of age, sort of underscores this godly contentment. And with this I close. She writes, "How many blessings I enjoy that other people don't. So weep or sigh because I'm blind, I cannot. And I won't. Oh, what a happy child I am, although I cannot see. I am resolved that in this world, contented, I will be. Pray with me. Father, thank you for giving us another opportunity to remember the source of our comfort and strength, our hope and our assurance, our contentment. It isn't in our fallen nature. It isn't in some success. It isn't found, as it were, down here under the sun. But in you, the creator of all there is. With your heads bowed for just a moment, perhaps the Spirit of God has pointed to an area. Maybe you're someone in power. How are those under your power being benefited? Maybe you need to start something or stop something. Maybe tomorrow needs a new beginning. Maybe you're driven in a world of competition, and frankly, you have to see that contract signed. Are they just clients? Are they just people? Are they just figures? Or are they real, genuine, needy people that God has put in your traffic pattern of life to testify that there's more than a contract at hand? Maybe you've arrived where you think, you know, you've done enough. It's time to be served. I think I'll fold my hands. Or perhaps it's an individual who says, you know, I haven't looked up enough to realize that people have begun leaving me alone in my isolated, self-centered world. Maybe something, a different scene at mine, but God's Spirit is at work, as He always does, through His Word. Have a conversation with Him now. Just a moment or two. Something to change, something to begin. Ask Him for strength and resolve. I am resolved that in this world, contented, I will be. While believers in this assembly are talking to their Lord, perhaps you don't know Christ. You're chasing the wind, scrambling up the hill. Take it from an old man who wrote in a journal that you can't catch the wind. It won't satisfy. It'll be a delight to point you, not to my advice, but to listen to my voice, but God's.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.